Hello and welcome to All Indians Matter. I am Ashraf Engineer. The National Register of Citizens or NRC was controversial from the start. At its core, it is an official record of citizens, but its implications extend well beyond that. So far, this record has been maintained only for the state of Assam. It was a state-specific exercise to keep its unique ethnicity unaltered. However, after the Narendra Modi government came to power, there was a concerted move to extend it across India. The NRC makes it extremely tough to prove citizenship, often disregarding documents that are generally considered valid for it. Those excluded from the NRC are to be lodged in detention centers reminiscent of concentration camps. Recently, the Union government said there is no decision to implement the NRC across India, and rules for the other highly controversial law, the Citizenship Amendment Act or CAA, may take till July 2021 to be framed. The nationwide protests before the COVID-19 pandemic against the CAA had their concerns rooted in the NRC. The fear was that the Hindu nationalist government would exclude largely minorities from the NRC, and those Hindus that were excluded would then be granted citizenship through the CAA route. This would effectively leave the excluded minorities stateless. The CAA permits citizenship for people of all faiths from the region, excluding Muslims only. With the Assam Assembly elections scheduled for mid-April, the NRC is again in the use and is being used heavily to polarize the electorate there.
All Indians Matter.
We have on the show Anas Tanveer Siddiqui, a key player in the NRC battle. Anas is an advocate on record for the Supreme Court and founder of the Indian Civil Liberties Union, or ICLU. The ICLU provides legal access to the excluded, making legal education and rights accessible to the ordinary and upholding democracy. It has worked on the Model Code of Conduct and Voting Rights, helped with the documentation of the underprivileged for the NRC in Assam, and created awareness about the NRC. It has also intervened in wrongful arrests, and it provides justice to those denied their rights. Anas is well known in the field of public advocacy and in defending freedom of speech, religion, and meaningful civic participation. Recently, Anas played an important role in formulating anti-lynching guidelines and curbing hate speech on television. He is a well-known columnist and speaker who advocates civil liberties and equal justice across India and the world. Anas, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ashraf, and thank you for having me. Over.
Anas, sir, could you explain in layman's terms what the NRC is? What exactly are the concerns about it, and how can it be used in conjunction with the CAA to exclude sections of society from citizenship? Tell us also the concerns over documentation. What documents that are normally used to prove citizenship are not valid for the NRC?
All right. So National Register of Citizens has been, as the name says, a register of citizens for all the country, all the citizens, basically right. Listing down who all are citizens and excluding those who don't have the proper documentation. It has been till date limited to state of Assam because of its very unique history and geography as well. So Assam has seen a large wave of immigration at different period of history, it has a very unique position in the law of citizenship as well. In so much so that a special provision has been inserted in Citizenship Act, that is the provision that is Section 6A, which says that a cutoff date for the for any person to be an Indian citizen entering Assam from the then East Pakistan will be 24th March 1971, which is not the case with the rest of India. So, and all of this has happened in backdrop of great violence that has happened, great trauma that the state has been through and its people have been through, their insecurities and lack of jobs, lack of opportunities. And all these has fueled the, if I may call it, a very bigoted discourse around the citizenship. So we, to understand what was the NRC that was concluded recently in 2019, we need to go back to 1951. So what the exercise that was undertaken, it was an exercise that was monitored by the Supreme Court of India, especially by a certain judge. And it was an exercise for the updation of the 1951 NRC. Now, in 1951, when the NRC was created, when the first list was out, it was not a complete list. There was not much public participation. There was not much public announcement. The officials would enter the name of the people in the list on their own. Sometimes people were not asked to show any documents. And also we need to take into account that a large scale of migration happened after the riots of 1950, where a lot of Muslims went to what is now Bangladesh.
Right.
But most of them came back after the Nehru-Liaquat Treaty. A large number of them came back to their own motherland, to India. They chose to stay in India. But because the exercise was by then completed by the state, they were automatically excluded. So what we are looking at is generation of people and their descendants who start at a clear disadvantage to others in the updation exercise. So how does this whole process work? So we need to understand this whole process of updation of the NRC. So there are two lists. List A and List B. List A documents could be your passport, your ration cards, or land documents. But these documents either should be prior to 1971, or or there should be a linkage. And your parents, your grandfather should have those documents that were prior to 1971.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a clear linkage and your name is in the, you have a List A document, technically you should get in NRC without any problem. List B documents are those documents that are considered weaker. And possibility of a great background check, of background of the document to be checked. So if you have a List B document, then you will have to have some corroborative evidence to prove that this document is correct and that you were in India before 24th March of 1971 in Assam, or you were or your parents or your grandfather was in India, and you can draw a clear linkage. But now what happens is if we talk about not even Assam, even of mainland India, how many of us can vouch that we have clear documents of prior to 1971 or 1950?
Very few.
And then those documents should be error-free. I'll give you an example. There was this case of Munawara Bewa. Now, Munawara Bewa, her initial documents mentioned her name as Munawara Khatun. Then she marries, her name changes to Munawara Begum. And then when she dies, her documents reflect her name as Munawara Bewa. Now, I as a Muslim, I do understand that Begum, Bewa is basically a widow. And Begum is a married woman. So these are honorific titles. This is not surname. But this lady was declared to be a foreigner.
Because her husband had died, her name changed to Munawara Bewa.
Yes, because they said that Munawara Bewa and Munawara Khatun are not the one and the same person.
Right.
Not just this, there can be typographical error. Your name can be Asghar, A-S-G-A-R, A-S-G-H-A-R, and it can be written very differently in Hindi.
Right.
So in such scenario, what happens is not everyone has those documents, and if they have those documents, there's obviously some or the other error. Then there's also a problem of language. Many of the officials are deputed from mainland India for recording the name in the voter list, etc. And here, there are certain words, syllables that are not in the Assamese language. So sa becomes cha.
Right.
Okay. So Sharik will be written, it will be pronounced as Sharik, but it will be written as Charik. All right, you're getting my point. So what happens is, in such a scenario, the courts and the officer concerned sees it as a fake document.
Right.
An afterthought of the document. So this is where the problem is.
Please continue. I was about to ask, you know, so how can it be used in conjunction with the CAA to exclude certain sections of society from citizenship?
Okay, so there is one argument that was often given by the state and those who support the state that tell us how without NRC CAA is problematic. How is it unconstitutional? How does it, you know, take away your citizenship? Because CAA effectively grants citizenship to certain section of people from certain countries. However, the problem comes, I mean, we'll go on the unconstitutionality of CAA later. In conjunction with the NRC, here's the problem. In 2019, 19.4 lakh people were excluded from the National Register of Citizens.
Right.
Now, these people, they're a large group which is a Muslim, who are Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
A Hindu, for example, who has been excluded from the NRC, can claim that he came from Bangladesh before 2014, December 2014, and will be granted citizenship by a fast-track process on the basis of his religion.
Right.
While a similarly placed Muslim cannot do that, cannot claim that because CAA excludes Muslims from these states, these countries. So this creates a bias. This creates an you know, arbitrary classification. And this goes against the very root of our constitutional rights, our fundamental rights, because we are equal. That's what the constitution says. And there can be reasonable classification among the equals, but classification based on religion is never a reasonable classification.
Right.
So this will effectively take away the secular character of our country. So in conjunction with CAA, NRC is very problematic because if this excess, even if we only talk about Assam, there are 19.4 lakh and from what the rumor mills have it, there are 6 to 7 lakh Muslims. So these 6 to 7 lakh Muslims are at a clear disadvantage. They cannot claim that, okay, we came from Bangladesh, all right, give us a chance. We came from Bangladesh, you give us a fast-track citizenship. They cannot claim that. While the neighbor who is a Hindu who and similarly plays excluded out of NRC can claim the same.
But unless if it goes against our constitution, then under what legal provisions was it implemented?
So we'll have to understand that without the rules, CAA has not been implemented yet. Okay, no one has been given the advantage of this law as for now. The thing is, it's my view and I should not be commenting on it because I have myself, I'm the advocate on for the at least two of the parties who have challenged this law and the matter is sub judice. I refrain from commenting on it. But there's one serious problem with the constitutionality of CAA. Even if we exclude NRC, even if we don't take NRC into consideration and we take it as a standalone law, then also it is problematic because the Section 3 of the Citizenship Act says, 31C, that anyone who is born after 2003 is an Indian citizen only when either of his parents are Indian citizen and the other is not an illegal immigrant. This amendment was made in 2003. Now, the problem here is that a Hindu who has been, or a non-Muslim rather, who has been excluded from the NRC can, even though he's an illegal immigrant, but will not, because of CAA, will not fall under this definition.
Right.
And any and therefore, a person born after 2003, if he is a non-Muslim, he is at clear clear advantage on citizenship. He has a better claim towards citizenship rather than a Muslim, who, if his parents, one of the parents are declared to be illegal immigrant, his citizenship is gone, even though he was born in India and he has lived all his life from 2003 to 2021 in India.
Right.
So this is what the problem with the... And therefore, it gets hit by Article 15. That there cannot be any discrimination based on religion.
Unless you said that NRC was initially or is so far restricted to Assam.
Yes.
But why is there now a demand for a nationwide implementation?
A lot of it has to do with the government. It was, I believe, in the BJP's election manifesto as well. And there is a feeling. There is a sense that there are too many, way too many people who have come from out of India who don't belong to India, and they are taking away our resources. Now, there is not a single authentic data to back this. Not at all. There has been no study on this. Matter of fact, in Assam, where this controversy has been going on since 1950, to reach its pinnacle during the Assam violence, Nelli massacre, so on and so forth, and successive governments trying to, you know, get a bite of this pie, because it is electorally very, very, very productive for different parties. Even matter of fact, even Congress party is committed towards this in Assam.
Right.
So as I was saying, there's no data to back it. Even in Assam, where this has been going on, there's not even single study on which there is a general agreement that this is an authentic data.
Right.
Those advocating NRC, those belonging to those tribes who believe to themselves to be indigenous, even they don't agree on the 1991 census or the 1981 census. They, most of them also rejected the 2019 NRC. So, and the data that has been presented by successive government, even in parliament, has no backing. It, I mean, it's not even logical. What they're saying was impossible. I mean, at one point, the governor of the then governor of the Assam in 1996, he wrote saying there are 6 lakh people coming in every day. It's not possible.
Yeah, it's simply not possible.
And today, if we see, and like there is this mumbo jumbo about continued, you know, continued immigration, illegal immigration in India. But you see the Bangladesh GDP is doing much better and far better than if we take it, you know, in comparison with the GDP of a state of Assam.
Right.
If the, and there is no religious persecution per se. There is no war that is going on. So there is no reason for people to migrate. No one migrates, you know, out of happiness. There's always,
they migrate out of compulsion.
Out of compulsion. And if their economy is doing well, there's employment, and their GDP is better than the state GDP of the Assam, then why will someone migrate? So this is all a hoax that has been created by successive generations now to basically grab power. It is nothing more than that. It is simply racial supremacy, linguistic supremacy, and economic supremacy, and nothing more than that.
So, Anas, these 19.4 lakh people that you mentioned that have not found place in the NRC, what recourse do they have?
So, the list that was offered, the 19.4 lakh people, can be said to be in a state of suspension. The government wants a review. The government wants to redo it. What the recourse was that these people will can appeal to Foreigners Tribunal and then to High Court and then to Supreme Court if they were excluded from the National Register of Citizens. Now, this exercise is a parallel exercise that has been going on for exclusion of people from citizenship, the Foreigner Tribunal route. So I will come to that later. So this is what the recourse they had, the recourse to appeal against their exclusion. But with the NRC not being gazettified yet, it has not been gazetted yet, and the rules of appeal have not been issued, we don't know what will happen to this list. Currently, there are 19.4 lakh people living in daily anxiety of losing citizenship, facing discrimination every single day. And these are very, very poor people. Most of them are very poor.
Right. In fact, since you mentioned that, there's also a lot of discretion given to local official officials, isn't it, on who can be excluded. So, could you explain that?
Okay, so we'll have to understand both the routes of excluding citizenship. One that I've mentioned is the NRC, where you have to give your document and say that you are an Indian citizen and there are linkage documents. The other route that has been continuously going on since forever now is the Foreigner Tribunal route. So what happens is that they are border police, and they have the authority to, if they find a person to be of suspicious origin or being a non-citizen or an illegal immigrant, they will send that person a notice through the Foreigner Tribunal. Now, what is this foreigner tribunal? Foreigner tribunals are the tribunals that are created under the Foreigners Act and the Foreigners Tribunal Order to determine the citizen whether to give opinion, not judgment, not order, but to give opinion on citizenship of a certain person.
Right.
Now, the members of these tribunals, they are contractual judges. They don't have a permanent job. They don't come by clearing an exam. They are nominated. It's a contractual job for a limited period and as per the willingness of the government. And the minimum qualification that is required is 10 years of practice.
Right.
Okay. 10 years or 7 years of practice. So, even I can be a member of a foreigner tribunal, even though I'm not a judge. This tribunal is not bound by the law of evidence or the law of... they're not governed by the law of evidence or, law of procedure. There's very little law that goes in. What they see is that a person who has been served notice, he comes, he will show that these are my following documents and the documents of my forefathers. And they show that we are an Indian citizen.
Right.
Now, the state need not even be present during this proceeding.
Right.
In most cases, I have done close to 50 such cases. In most cases, state does not lead evidence. Since the 2003 judgment of the Supreme Court in Sarbananda and the Sonowal, it's a very problematic judgment. The burden of proof has shifted on these people, or the noticee, the person who has been served a notice.
Right.
Now, it's a the technical word that is used is opposite party, OP. Okay. So, the burden of proof has shifted on them. The tribunal judge, the member of the tribunal here, acts as the prosecution and as a judge. He dons both the hats, which is against the very principle of natural justice. And now, we'll have to understand the socioeconomic condition of these people. These are very poor people. These are mostly uneducated. They come, they are overwhelmed by a person sitting on a dais who is asking them questions. Who was your father? What was his spelling? Can you bring in a witness? So on and so forth. They get confused. Sometimes, even though their documents are correct, they make certain statements that are contradictory. In some cases, the documents are all correct. They are all present. They are all there. And yet the tribunal will declare them to be foreigner. Last year, matter of fact, a news article was published where certain members were removed from the foreigner tribunal. And they said that they were removed because they were not giving a certain quota of exclusion. So a state that is working very enthusiastically towards removing its own people, towards declaring its own people as non-citizens, throwing them into detention centers, or worse, deporting them, even though we don't have a deportation treaty with Bangladesh. So this is all a very dangerous situation. So I'll just give an example. There was this case of Asghar Ali. Asghar Ali was not even from Assam. He was from West Bengal, Baliganj. And he was working as a carpenter in Assam. He was served a notice. He presented himself before the tribunal. Among the documents, he annexed his father's passport, court documents, court summons in his name and his father's name to the address of his West Bengal home. And he also annexed voter list of 1966 and 1971 of West Bengal, Baliganj constituency. Where the name of his father and his grandfather were clearly mentioned on the same address. And this was like, this is the best case scenario. Anyone having so many valid documents is very rare.
Right.
But what does the tribunal say? The tribunal, which is not bound by the law of evidence, goes into law of evidence and says that this 1966 and 1971 voter list has been issued by the Department of Directorate of Archive, West Bengal, and it is not a proper custodian of the document. So there is no mistake on my part. Yet, I am declared a foreigner. Now, I go to High Court and I go with an RTI response which says that even under the Evidence Act, this Directorate of Archive is in fact the custodian. The High Court, again, does not give any consideration to this RTI or to this response and dismisses our case. And I stand as a foreigner. Then I come to Supreme Court. And at this point, Justice Ranjan Gogoi is the Chief Justice. Mm-hmm. All the matters related to foreigner tribunal, most of the matters are listed before him. And this is the time when the first list of NRC has been published. Right. I, of course, don't find my name in NRC because I'm not supposed to be there. I'm a resident of West Bengal, if any. I'm not a resident of Assam. I should not be in NRC. And logically, my name was not in NRC.
You're talking about the carpenter here.
Yes, the carpenter. Sorry, as a lawyer, my habit is two of my clients.
Right.
So, Asghar obviously does not find his name in NRC. Now, we go before the Supreme Court, before the bench of Justice Gogoi, and he dismisses the matter in less than 1 minute. Only on the ground, I mean, he mentioned this. Obviously, this does not reflect in the order. The order only says SLP dismissed. On the ground that my name is not in NRC. I was not even supposed to be in NRC, and that was not even my case. So today, Asghar Ali has been released from detention because he has spent a considerable period in detention center. Mm-hmm. But he is still a non-Indian. He's not a citizen of India right now. He does not enjoy the rights. He cannot seek a gainful employment with the government. He can't have a bank account.
So, Anas, what sort of legal interventions have you been making on their behalf? I mean, you already mentioned one case, but could you recount some of the more telling cases you've come across and the kind of legal interventions you make?
Yeah, sure. So, as a lawyer, I have filed close to 50 cases. Mm-hmm. In most of the cases, we were led by Mr. Sanjay Hegde, senior advocate, who also does these cases pro bono. This is one way of the intervention that we make, that we file the special leave petition against the order of the High Court. That is one aspect which I do as a lawyer. Then as a founder of ICLU, what we did was when the list was issued, the final list of NRC was issued, there was a lot of panic and we started getting calls. So we issued a helpline number for any person who does not find his name in NRC to guide him what step he or she can take next. That was the first intervention we made. We released certain primers in Assamese, Bengali, English and Hindi. And we, through the social media, WhatsApp groups and others, we circulated it everywhere in Assam, that if a person does not find his name in NRC, what he or she can do. Then in around October of 2019, we went to Assam. We were perhaps the first civil liberty organization from mainland India to go to Assam in the BTC areas, in districts like Udalguri, etc., Ekadapadi. And we held our legal aid camps where we took copies of the documents from these people, told them where the problem was. And we were surprised to see a repeat of pattern. In a family of four, two were in NRC on the basis of the same documents, on which other two were excluded. So there was obviously a problem with the department concerned. And this is where I come back to your question. The person who is sitting at the counter, who is receiving the documents from these people, has the power to tell them that this document is not acceptable. He might not be a senior officer. He might not be a judge of those documents. But he does have the powers to say, no, absolutely not. We will not accept this document. Now, even though I have a document, I cannot present it. And therefore, I'm excluded out of NRC. And this has to be seen in conjunction with the prejudice. In Assam, there is a very deep-rooted prejudice against Bengali-speaking people. The genesis of it begins from 1901. But so these prejudices, these social conditions will have to be taken into account. And this 19.4 lakh people who have been excluded, majority of them have been excluded erroneously. In all the cases that I have seen, I can vouch. Even the cases that have been dismissed by Supreme Court, I can vouch that these are Indian citizens. Many even had documents as old as 1930s, and yet they were excluded. So there is a problem in the system here.
Right. But you know, honestly, the legal aspect is one part of it. What kind of suffering does this exercise entail in terms of human cost?
Immediately before, when NRC was published, some people were sent notice to appear as far as from 500 kilometers for re-verification. This re-verification, Supreme Court had clearly said that you cannot do this. Yet the state said, state did not care. And they sent notice to these people. And in that process, these poor people arranged money from somewhere. They rushed to those places. And there were a series of accidents that happened because it was monsoon. And close to 60, 70 people died in those accidents. Till date, from if I remember correctly, more than 100 people have committed suicide. There was this case, and I mean, I'm very proud of doing this case. I'm proud of all the people involved in this case. The case of Asghar and Asghar Ali and Kismat Ali. But, I mean, not giving details, just to give context, that when Asghar was sent into detention, his daughter was 3 months old. When he came out, his daughter was 6 years old and she had not seen her father. So the families are split. People are excluded. There was someone who had a government job and was excluded. I still remember his face. He would cry every time he would call me. And the Supreme Court did not intervene in that matter. And he was a government servant. He was working in PWD as a cook. His brother was a cleaner in PWD. His brother's citizenship was never questioned. And so I remember these names. I remember these faces. Most of the people I have met, I mean, most of the cases that I've done, I've never even met the client because the Wakalatnama and affidavit comes from there through the lawyer, because these people don't know how to come to Supreme Court. It's not easy for them to access justice at this level. So my whole job, the only reason why I do these cases, because matter of fact, by last year, I had lost the objective detachment from these cases. I became emotional about them because the suffering was too high. I took a pause from doing such cases because as a lawyer, I need to have objective detachment.
Right.
So the human cost is way too high and economic cost more so. We have spent billions of rupees in a list that no one is ready to accept, all because of whims and fancy of a single judge who now sits in Rajya Sabha.
But also, Anas, could you describe what it's like in the detention centers?
So I have spoken to my clients who have come out. I've seen reports. So detention centers are very different from jails. Jails are better. In Assam, there are 4 or 5 detention centers. They are making a lot, many more, and they're making more detention centers all over India now. There are 4 or 5 major detention centers, and they are in the jail campus. So these people are given a block in the same jail where you may find the hardened criminals. Now, these hardened criminals who may be under trial or convicts, they have the right, certain rights through jail manual. These people don't have those rights. The government has made some initiative last year from what I remember, but I'm not sure how far has it been implemented. They don't have those rights. They can't work. They can't earn. Technically speaking, they don't have a right to bail or parole. Many, those who go inside, they lose their mental faculty because you are not doing anything all day. In a barrack where there is a space for 25 people, there will be more than 100. And women have it all the more bad. The conditions are really, really, really bad. We are a proud nation. We claim, like, today itself, our Prime Minister said that we are mother of democracy. In a democracy, such human right violations in the name of law, by the process of law, are taking place every day. There are people suffering. So Supreme Court came out. Supreme Court said that those who have spent more than 3 years should be let out. Those who are old and infirmed during the COVID, they were let out. But even 3 years sitting doing nothing, you lose your mental faculty. You can't see your family. There is no way out of this. A lot of them, they don't come out. They come out, there has been cases where families have refused to bury, saying that you declared them to be Bangladeshi, then please bury them in Bangladesh. The human cost is way too high and people don't understand. People have very bigoted notions, very selfish motives, the human cost is way too high.
Anas, the government initially said that the CAA would follow the NRC. Then it said that the two are not linked. Where do you think the CAA-NRC battle will eventually lead, and what do you think will eventually happen of the two?
See, both the statements are from the same institution or the same person or the same establishment. So we don't know for sure, and it is only, I mean, the government knows what they're planning to do. But my understanding is that given the pushback that the government has faced due to CA and the protests that took place all over India, and the fact that our economy is not very strong right now, and any such exercise will be a very, very big burden on the state exchequer. Because if billions were spent for a state of Assam that has a far lesser population or geographical area compared to, say, West Bengal or Uttar Pradesh, I can't even imagine what will be the cost of this exercise. Then there's also the part where the different state governments have said that they will not allow such exercise to take place. And this exercise cannot be undertaken only on the central resources. The states will have to contribute. And if the states fail to do so, and if it's even one state that fails to do so, then it will not be a national waste of citizen in true sense. So I find the whole idea of this exercise, and I will actually, if I have to recommend this to government, I will ask them to, you know, drop this plan, because there is no data backing this exercise. There is no need for this exercise, and we are in no way in a position to conduct any such exercise.
And so we've seen things like the SEA and NRC only in the last 6 years or so. And unfortunately, this is combined with lynchings in the name of cow protection, killings of minorities, essentially the normalization of majoritarian and authoritarian politics, which says that you're either a part of the majority or you're a second-class citizen with restricted rights. Do you agree with this assessment? And if yes, what do you think lies ahead for India?
I completely agree with this assessment. There's no doubt about it that the our politics has become majoritarian. The institutions, see, a democracy is always majoritarian. It is the institutions that give it the color of a secular color or a socialist color. And it is the duty of the majority. It is rather a promise by the majority that they will protect the minority. But if the majority refuses to do so and actively starts attacking, then there is very less that, you know, minorities can do. And this is what is happening now. What they want is an acceptance that you are a second-class citizen, that you cannot claim the similar rights. It has not happened in Assam yet, but this whole idea of NRC is also to take away voting rights from a section of people, thereby changing the voter demography of certain regions. There is a lot of study that has gone into this. Mm-hmm. However, and this whole thing, this whole controversy started because of an election. When there was a rumor that Indira Gandhi will be contesting from one of the constituency in Assam, that was a Muslim majority. That's where this whole thing of foreigner and Bengali and Muslim Mia erupted. So, end of the day, it is the fact that every person has a single vote is problematic for those who want to impose their majoritarian or authoritarian politics. They want to change the demographic. And this is what I believe is something very sinister behind this. And not only this. See, we don't have a deportation treaty with Bangladesh. If you're talking about Bangladesh, if you're saying that there are Bangladeshis that have come into India, we don't have a deportation treaty. You can't send them to Bangladesh. And until unless Bangladesh accepts that certain people, yes, they are our citizens, they won't take them. And you can't keep so many people, 19.4 lakh people in detention center. Because your strength is this population. This is your dividend. And you put 19.4 lakh people behind detention center, and obviously the to feed them and to keep them, it will be state's duty, because we'll have to abide by the laws and the jail conditions or the detention center conditions. It will be a continued burden on the state exchequer. So what will you do? One of the things that was proposed around 3 years back in an affidavit by the government was that government suggested that we will put a GPS on these people.
19.4 lakh people?
At that point, there were not 19.4 lakh people. The list was not out by then. Mm-hmm. There was just a discussion that was going on in one of the matters. So they will put GPS on these people, trackers on these people. And most importantly, if you're not a citizen, you don't really have a right to employment or right to claim equality. So we'll go back to the times when there were Bandhwa Mazdoors.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll go back to the time of feudalism. And this does not behove well for a democracy, for a vibrant democracy.
Absolutely. And it's shocking.
It is shocking.
Anas, my final question. Tell us about the Indian Civil Liberties Union, which you founded. How did it come about and what is the work that it's been doing?
Okay, long story. So a lot of things that I've done in my life, I have done because I was angry. And ICLU is also one of my those projects where I was just angry that I had to do something. So the backdrop is that when this government came, Akhlaq was lynched and there was a series of lynchings. So I, as a lawyer, with three clients, Tehseen Poonawalla, Martin McWan, and Mohan Bhai Bedwa was in fact a victim of lynching in Gujarat. And so we approached the Supreme Court saying, see, all these things is happening. This is not good. Lot of these organizations that are indulging in lynching, they enjoy the protection of law under the Animal Protection Act and state rules, and no one has a right to take law in their hand. We relied on the Salva Chudum judgment, etc. While the matter was pending in the Supreme Court, few of us came up with a civil society movement of drafting an anti-lynching law. So the anti-lynching law was drafted by me, my colleague, under the guidance of Mr. Sanjay Hegde. And we started a civil society movement that did not receive much success, but yes, there was something to talk about. When this matter came up again in the Supreme Court for the final hearing, in order to assist the Supreme Court, we gave a modified draft of the laws that we had framed to Supreme Court for its consideration. The matter was before Justice Deepak Mishra, and Deepak Mishra was one of the judge who really in his heart wanted to do something, and he always wanted to do something good about everything. He had those notions of justice. So he passed an order that incorporated most of the provision of the draft law as guideline. So when Supreme Court issues the mandatory guidelines, they are as good as a law. Supreme Court also requested the union government to come up with a new law on lynching. The union government conducted a meeting with us and nothing came out of it. There is a committee that has been formed, but no steps have been taken to promulgate any such law. State of Rajasthan, state of Manipur, and state of West Bengal, they in fact adopted these draft laws to a very great extent and passed anti-lynching laws. But these laws, even after 2-3 years, they are awaiting consent of the president, which obviously comes by on the aid and advice of the union cabinet. Now, all this was going on after the judgment. Somehow I felt that the incidents of lynching were going down. There was not much news until I read the news of lynching of Tabrez in Latehar, Jharkhand. And That was on page 13 of Indian Express. In corner, a very small news. And that's when I realized that we have normalized lynching. It is not even making it to the first page. It has become a norm. It is not an exceptional situation. And that made me really angry. And I realized that we may come out with 1,000 laws. We may come out with 100 guidelines. But until unless they are implemented at a very ground level, it will have no impact. So in order to act as a pressure group, as an advocacy group, I, along with a few friends, a non-lawyer friend, my colleague Sanuba Fatma, and others, we started this organization and we created a network, which was very useful in Tabe's case itself, because the police there wanted to file a FR, that is final report, saying there's no lynching or anything. And we wrote to the Director General of Police and the SSP saying, no, you have to abide by the Supreme Court guidelines. You will have to reinvestigate this matter if you are to file the FR. So the police made a U-turn and they filed a charge sheet against the accused person. Then, out of this anger, this organization was created. Then came the general elections and the parties were flouting the model code of conduct at their whim and fancy. So we started a hashtag called We Are Watching. And we asked for public to inform us if they see any violation of model code of conduct, etc. And there was we received a good reaction and we intervened in close to 50, 60 such cases, and in many cases against cabinet ministers, even against the prime minister. And EC did some measures, some action against people, and obviously it had no impact on the election result. We were not doing it with an idea of any impact on the election result. We just wanted a free and fair election. But, and then this CA happened, people were getting arrested everywhere, and we started intervening. And then there are other aspects where we help, we conduct our rural education classes on law. We are training students of class 11th and 12th. We are inspiring them to take law as a profession. Then we also, even though it was not our mandate, but we helped close to 40,000 people reach their homes during the migrant crisis. So these are the things that we have done. Right. There is a lot more in store. There are certain laws that we want to draft. We want to have a civil society movement. One of them is an anti-discrimination law. Then there's anti-bullying laws, that bullying of kids in school. So these are the things we are currently working on, and hopefully in future you'll hear more from us.
And Anas, we wish you great luck for that. Thanks so much for being on the show. The NRC is one of the most critical national issues of our time and has the potential to impact the very nature of India and its future. So thank you for helping listeners understand it better.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me over. It was my pleasure.
And thank you all for listening. Please visit allindiansmatter.in. That's allindiansmatter.in for more columns and audio podcasts. You can follow me on Twitter at Ashraf Engineer. That's AshrafEngineer. And All Indians Count. That's AllIndiansCount. Search for the All Indians Matter page on Facebook. On Instagram, the handle is All Indians Matter. Email me at editor@allindiansmatter.in.